I'm pleased to announce our next speaker. Dr. Vargas is a sports neurologist and experienced sideline physician. He will share his clinical expertise regarding acute and a post-acute management of concussion at all levels of play. Dr. Vargas is currently the director of the Sports Neurology and Concussion Program at UT Southwestern in Dallas. He is also an unaffiliated neurotrauma consultant serving the Dallas Cowboys and the NFL. He is board certified in neurology and a fellow of the American Headache Society. Prior to his recent move, and I'd say recent, pretty past 3 months maybe by now, he's now a Texan. He was a neurotrauma consultant for Arizona State University and Northern Arizona University football and a women's university women's soccer. Dr. Vargas's unique history also includes military service in the United States Air Force as a flight surgeon with numerous deployments in support of Operation Northern Watch, Enduring Freedom, and Iraqi Freedom. So many times we often neglect that athletes are also our military personnel, and so thank you for bringing that perspective to us, and really excited to have you. And also, Dr. Resch, I wanted to say that comment that athletic trainers really, in my opinion, are the unsung heroes of sports medicine. We often don't give you enough of appreciation for what you contribute to the sports medicine team, and they're the glue that really holds us all together. Definitely could not do my job every single day without you, so thanks to them as well. So, Dr. Vargas?
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me here today, and it's just it's a real pleasure to join you and talk a little bit about something that I love very much, and that's working with athletes and that encompasses a lot of things. So not just concussion. So it's nice to know that that there's a little bit more breadth to what we do. Just real quick, some disclosures. I have no disclosures other than I'm a University of Arizona guy on an Arizona State sideline. I tried to keep that under wraps with them for a little while. The only other thing to keep in mind is that everything in this talk with a really good, strong evidence base, or actually let's say without a strong evidence base, is on a white background. So that's pretty much everything except for my title slide. Just a couple of quick points about treating pilots, and this really kind of lays the groundwork for how I found myself in this space and why it just seems like it was just destined to happen that I would end up going into this, is that in working with pilots, they're very much like athletes in the sense that they're a population of very incredibly healthy people. I mean, they're selected out as being healthier than most, and because of that, they fly and they enjoy doing what they do, and they hate being taken out of that environment. So frequently, they'll underreport their injuries. And frequently, they'll try and find ways to return to duty a lot earlier than they should. And so sometimes that leads to a lot of other complications and other issues. And it was just interesting that as my life transitioned into treating athletes, I found myself working in sort of the same situation, where now I, again, have a population of people that are generally very healthy. And they continue to underreport their injuries. They try and downplay how they're feeling, and sometimes they downright lie to you and tell you that everything's okay when it's not. And of course, one of the goals, just like with military populations, is to try and catch some of these subtle issues and try and prevent people from returning to activity prematurely and potentially causing some long-term issues. So Dr. Resch covered a lot of things that are done on the sideline at the time of injury, and I think one thing that you'll see between the three of our talks, so Dr. Resch and me and Dr. Condor, is that there is a little bit of overlap in the talks, and that's good because that actually shows you that each of these time points in treatment and evaluation of patients is really a continuum, and it really should actually mesh very well together. And there should be a lot of talk between the all the parties involved in treating the athletes, and so they shouldn't be put into these silos. So this actually works out very perfectly. Now, I'll spare you some of the details that Dr. Resch has already gone over on some of these items, and of course, I'll refrain from going into detail on some things that Dr. Condor is going to cover. But a couple of points about history. And just as Dr. Rush mentioned, history is quite important. And the way I sort of approach this in a clinic standpoint, so after the time of injury, is really looking into the past, the present, and the future, really. And by the past, I'm talking about I need to know that athlete better. I'd say the overwhelming majority of the time, the physicians that are taking care of the athlete after the injury really don't know the athlete. And that's why the input of the athletic trainer is so key. These are individuals that are working with the athletes every single day, and they know when subtle issues occur. So I'm already behind the eight ball a little bit in many cases when I'm working with the athletes that come into my clinic. So in getting to know them, I need to know a little bit about their history. I need to know what their medical history is, and I even need to know what their developmental history is, so I can take into context issues like ADHD and other developmental disorders when I try and estimate where I think that they should be clinically. And then, of course, it's going to be important to know your athlete's concussion history and how or whether they actually recovered from those previous injuries to kind of help you not only strategize what your treatment plan is going to be, but also help to kind of begin to get your brain working as to, okay, how intensive is this rehab going to be? Understanding current issues is really kind of the present of the history, and that's really going into detail about the symptoms and the severity, because it in many cases what we're working with is actually symptomatic treatment, and so it's going to be important to really uncover those symptoms and find out how bad they are at the time that you're evaluating them. And part of that includes also looking into what sort of impact that has been having on their schoolwork and on their other activities. The last part that I see as important is really looking into the future. Okay, so once we fix the current problem, how are we going to prevent it from happening again? And we'll go into a little bit more detail with that. As far as symptoms go, they're numerous. I mean, I'm not going to go over all the things on this particular slide, and you saw them on the last talk as well. This really does remind me, though, that at this point, one of the biggest barriers to effective concussion science is really the definition of concussion and the fact that we do not have a unified definition at this point. And you'll hear people say, is it the actual event? Is it the structural or is it the metabolic issues that are going on within the brain, or is it the symptom complex? And you'll see people debate both sides of that. And so because of that, there's a lot of there's a lot of incomplete science. There's a lot of good science out there, but there's a lot of incomplete answers to the questions that we're looking for. But in treating it as a symptom complex, at least for the purposes of this talk, there's a number of symptoms, and as you saw in the last talk, headache is really at the top of the list and is one that I'm going to focus on in a little bit. As you saw, the SCAT-3 there's also some debate on how to incorporate this or whether to incorporate this into the evaluation of your athlete. And you know, the answer that I have for this, whenever I'm asked about the SCAT-3, especially certain components of the SCAT-3 and some other tools, is that it's not a great test, but it's the industry standard. It's the language that everyone speaks at the moment. So in many respects, we're sort of forced to speak that language until we develop a better language. So I think the best thing that we can do, the best service that we can provide, is that if we're going to use these tools, that we use them correctly. And I think that I have lost count of the number of times that I see these tests being performed incorrectly. So if you're going to use them, but use them correctly. As far as symptom checklists go, especially if we're thinking that concussion is the symptom complex, this is going to be very important, and this is going to be a pivotal part of your evaluation. And I think the other nuance to this is whether or not you're going to have the athlete sit in the waiting room and fill out this symptom checklist on their own and just hand it in, keeping in mind that, you know, when patients are in the waiting room and they have a stack this thick of forms to fill out, there's sort of a form-filling fatigue that happens, and you run across the people who just, you know, draw a straight line through things, or maybe don't give some good thought into their answers, which is why in many respects it's a much better idea to actually do this part of your evaluation face-to-face with the athlete. So you actually ask the questions and go into depth with them. And it takes some time, but I find it to be incredibly high yield. The other issue, of course, is you know, whether or not it's parent-assisted. And this can go either way. I know many of you have seen the parent who hovers a bit and perhaps catastrophizes exactly what's going on. And then you also have the parent who gives you a really good and important feedback into some subtle issues that they see in their child that their child doesn't necessarily want to report. And the biggest one would be some mood symptoms. So I can't even tell you how many times an athlete will say, well, you know, I feel fine. But then their parents say, well, yeah, they've been a bit more moody than usual. As far as the physical exam goes, I didn't spend much time on the details of these slides because they're sort of self-explanatory. Yeah, you need vital signs, you need a general exam, you need a musculoskeletal exam. But I do want to say that for the vital signs, I think that there's been a widely growing amount of evidence at this point of some issues with orthostatic intolerance and symptoms that mimic those of POTS. And because of that, I do always throw in orthostatic blood pressures, just because I also find that to be incredibly high yield. And in many cases, when people come in and they report dizziness, at least to a neurologist, dizziness doesn't mean anything, right? A lot of things are dizzy. Dizzy could be lightheaded. Dizzy could be imbalanced. Dizzy could just be not feeling right or feeling cloudy. And so so especially in people who are reporting dizziness that presents as lightheadedness, that's where your orthostatic blood pressures are going to be incredibly useful. The neurologic exam, you saw a great video of it, so I won't spend too much time on that. I found a great stat that the sensitivity and specificity for finding an abnormality is 0.61. I would argue that it depends on the person doing the exam. I'd hope that my sensitivity is a little bit better than 0.6, but you know, you never know. Again, with the SCAT-3, you know, in doing the cognitive assessment portion of the exam, this is one that I tend to not do in an after injury assessment in the clinic. And as Dr. Resch mentioned, there's a lot of practice effect with this. And it, you know, does it really give you any useful information? This is a screening tool. I would find probably not. And so I tend to avoid this. I'll use my own screening tools, but in reality, I rely heavily upon my neuropsychologists to actually give me the proper information that I need on cognitive performance. A couple of notes on the balance error scoring system. Again, this is a slide that you saw previously. There are the sensitivities and the specificities. Basically, every single component of the SCAT is really all over the place. And I would say that this is probably the most subjective part of the exam, especially when the inter-rater reliability is just absolutely horrible. Baseline performance is also incredibly variable. And in fact, this is a couple of points that that many of us in this room have agreed upon, is that the worst part about the balance error scoring system is that on the front end, where you're doing a double leg stance, right, where your feet are together and you're just standing with your hands on your hips, everyone does well on it. So it's incredibly undersensitive. Right? I mean, even when people are slightly impaired, they tend to be able to do that well. Now, to be fair, it is incredibly specific, so if people can't even do that and they're falling over the place, well, chances are there's a problem. On the other end, you have the single leg stance, which is incredibly hard. And so you'll see a number of normal people who can't do it and pass it. And so on the opposite end, you have something that's incredibly oversensitive. So you've got populations of people that fail the exam, and by fail, you know, they max out the number of points before they even have an injury. So how does that really help? in determining whether or not there's a change from baseline. So clearly, there needs to be some change in the tools that we use. Some other tools include King-Divick, and you heard King-Divick talked about earlier. I think for the time that it takes to administer, I find it to be incredibly helpful. But I would also add that no tool is perfect, and multiple tools used together, along with your clinical exam and your expertise, is really the way to go. And you'll see that KD is abnormal in about 80%, and the SAC is much less sensitive, but helpful in 52% of the cases. But when you combine them, then you're getting into the 90s. And then when you include a balance exam and some clinical insight, then you're getting close to 100. And so really the take-home point there is that there's no one tool that you should necessarily use in isolation. And to really do due diligence to the evaluation of your athlete, you really need multiple evaluations of multiple things. As far as when to obtain additional studies, and this is the question that comes up all the time, especially even in my headache practice, as far as, okay, well, when do I image, when do I not image, when do I order additional studies? Well, in the emergency department, so after the athlete has left the field, and let's say they make it to the emergency department, most imaging in concussion is going to be normal. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that we're talking about metabolic and structural issues that are far smaller than the sensitivity of what a CT scan can pick up. But yet, I mean, how many people go in and they get a CT scan and it's completely normal? And in many respects, I think that actually lends a lot of confusion to the athlete and to the family, where they're saying, I don't feel right, but why is everything normal? So, like most other things, there is a time and a place, though, and when do you obtain a CT scan? I would say if someone has some type of neurologic deterioration, so if they have, as Dr. Resch pointed out, signs of stroke, seizure, prolonged loss of consciousness, any focality to their neurologic exam, in that acute setting, I think that CT is going to be higher yield. And part of that is the fact that CT is very good at picking out bony abnormalities, so it's going to help you pick out things like skull fractures. It's also incredibly sensitive at picking out hemorrhage. So for those reasons, never mind also the fact that it's a whole lot cheaper than ordering an MRI, that's probably the test of choice in that acute setting. But once they make it to your outpatient clinic, and once they've been wrestling with their symptoms for a few days at this point, I would then argue that CT is actually not going to be the way to go. And there I'm a little bit in conflict with some of the guidelines that would still recommend CT. But in reality, if after several days you have some continued focality to your exam or there are some new or developing neurologic symptoms, MRI is actually going to be far more sensitive at picking something up. Now, I would still say that only on very rare instances would you ever need to image your usual concussion patient. It's just not necessary in most situations. And even though I listed MRI up there, you'll see that it has an asterisk. And the reason is because there are some specialized MRI evaluations that can pick up abnormalities in concussion. And that includes DTI, that includes functional MRI, and maybe even to some degree MR spectroscopy. Those are really not ready for prime time at the moment. Those are really still experimental, and I don't think that we truly know what their place is going to be in the future evaluation of concussion. And so I would say that at this point this should not be a standard part of the exam. But do I do it? Yeah, I do. And I typically save it for people who are really not progressing or doing poorly or even worse, getting worse over time. One of the, bigger, I think, debates of many debates within this space is that on the concept of rest. And so to rest or not to rest. And I think we've seen a huge shift away from this dark closet approach of taking a concussed athlete and putting them in this dark environment where they're not allowed to talk to anyone and they're not allowed to use their phone or watch movies and not allowed to go to school. And I think we find that ends up being detrimental to the overall rehab of the athlete. And so, but still to this point, like with concussion, I don't think there's a very good definition of what cognitive and physical rest is. That's really hard to describe. And I think that despite some of the research on how much is too much and how much is too little, we have yet to identify any sort of sweet spot for how much how much rest is going to be effective. And we also need to really reassess and reevaluate our treatment goals. And by that I mean that really in most cases with student athletes, the student part is the part that should be emphasized, and that we should really be looking at a return to learn before we're looking at a return to play. And then of course, is strict rest actually counterproductive? One of the things that I think we need to do as a community of people in the concussion space is to look at the data that we're presented with a critical eye. Even the data that we know that we truly believe is correct. And so this is an example of a study. It's shown all the time. You guys have probably seen this study about a million times at this point. And this is the Thomas study from pediatrics on the randomized controlled trial of strict rest. And it supports the notion that I think many of us believe that strict rest is not a good idea. But keep in mind that the study itself, I think has some issues. And the only reason I bring that up is because I think that we need to continue to look at this. That's the only reason that I bring that up. But I mean, if you look, we're talking about a difference in symptom scores of 3 points after 10 days, and we're talking about populations where even in the strict rest group of people who were supposed to be strict rest, no school, between days 2 and 5, they're still doing a half day of school. So, I'm not sure that this really proves what we believe to be true, but I think it is supportive, and I think this is a springboard for some future studies that are going to be really important on the importance of exercise. Now, there have been some groups, though, that have really tried to incorporate exercise into their rehab and have demonstrated how effective it can be in the recovery of an athlete after concussion. From a neurologist point of view, I think we've accepted for a very long time about the health benefits and the brain benefits of regular exercise. And I think now we're starting to actually incorporate that into the rehab routine. And I think it's paying off very well. So there are a few groups that have actually done a lot of work on using a specific treadmill test in the rehab of their athletes, and it seems to be very effective. And I certainly have begun to incorporate some degree of sub-threshold exercise into the recovery of my athletes as well. And by sub-threshold, I mean to the point at which they're starting to exhibit symptoms. You don't want to hit that point. A couple of points about post-traumatic headache, and the reason I give post-traumatic headache several of its own slides is because it is the most common symptom after concussion. And to the tune of about, anywhere from 90 to 98% of people after concussion will have some type of headache. So I think because of that warrants a little extra attention. One thing that I have to say that even goes into every headache talk I've ever given is that you have to know the phenotype, right? The accurate diagnosis of the headache phenotype then leads to sort of the best treatment algorithm, right? So I'd say the majority of people who come to see me with headache that are not getting better are not getting better only because they're sort of on a different pathway, right? They're being treated as tension type headache, or they're being treated as sinus headache or something other than migraine, let's say. And keep in mind that migraine or probable migraine is going to be the most common phenotype in the post-traumatic headache population. I would also say that that athletes and people with concussion are very unique in the sense that their headache is not primary, right? By primary, like people with migraine, like many of you in the audience even, you just exhibit migraine, right? At some point in your life, it triggers, and then you continue to have it. With an athlete in the context of concussion, there is a cause and effect relationship. And because of that, I don't consider this really a primary disorder. I consider it a secondary disorder with a number of other potential contributors. Keep in mind that the neck is a powerful contributor to headache, and vice versa. And musculoskeletal injuries are very common in athletes and very common in concussion. So that's one reason why the musculoskeletal exam is just so key. And then, of course, the other thing is medications and their overuse frequently contribute to headache or even just the refractory nature of headache. And in several studies on pediatrics, I believe it was upwards of 70% of people with ongoing headache past 1 to 3 months actually had international headache disorder classified medication overuse. And so we just need to be cautious about, making sure that we're being very judicious about the medications we use and how often we're telling people to use them. Treating the headache like it most resembles. I mean, post-traumatic headache has its own definition. It has its own classification. But at this point, with zero evidence, again, you see a white slide, right? There's no strong evidence on this. We are left to treat it like the primary headache disorder that it most closely exhibits. As far as treatment goes, I won't go into detail. This is a list, and you can look up any list of evidence-based treatments for headache. I just want to emphasize again that diagnosis is key. Ask the questions that you need to ask for migraine. Ask the questions that you need to ask for, other types of primary headache disorders, because then that's going to get you on the right path for which medication to pick. Let's see here. Just a last point on why I tend to treat this pretty aggressively is that athletes with headache tend to not do as well. And so they tend to do worse on their neurocognitive testing. And even some of the data that some colleagues of mine are presenting here indicate that a more severe headache actually does seem to correlate with much higher GAD-7 and PHQ-9 scores. So I think that argues that all of these domains, not only the psychological, but also the physical with headache, really should be treated aggressively. Let's see here. I think Dr. Resch covered some of these other symptoms, vestibular, cognitive, oculomotor, and some of their rehab, so I won't spend too much time on that. This is really old data, just kind of showing the basis of I think, where people get this number in their head of people recovering in about a week. Keeping in mind that this is old data on college football players, and you see that as far as symptom recovery and as far as cognitive performance and their stability on BESS, basically this is all SCAT-3, or at the time SCAT-2 data. It takes about 7 days, or at least the majority of them resolve in 7 days. But that's not really the way this plays out for a lot of other people, especially youth athletes, who can take 2, 3, sometimes even 5 weeks to regain their baseline performance on various cognitive modalities. As far as return to play goes, this is right out of the Zurich consensus. You see this 6-point graduated return to play protocol. I think that this will have some minor changes over time. I mean, for instance, at the top where it says no activity, I think at this point many of us are really not comfortable telling someone to completely eliminate all activity, and ideally everyone should progress through each of these steps and remain asymptomatic for at least 24 hours, but I would also say that with youth athletes in particular, I tend to be a lot more conservative, and I'll actually put people through each of these steps over the course of several days even, or depending on how severe, maybe even weeks, before they're moved on to the next step. It's very individual that way. But the milestones that I'm looking for is, are they symptom-free, first of all? And you'll note that I put symptom-free in quotes. And the reason is because I think we shouldn't necessarily get hung up on the fact that we want a complete absence of symptoms. In fact, the majority of athletes will have some degree of symptoms even at their normal healthy baseline. And so, I think my symptom severity score right now is about 10 because I didn't get my coffee this morning. But just keep in mind, we want to look more at like a baseline symptom severity score. And again, that goes back to knowing the athlete. And again, that goes back to the very important data that our athletic trainers have on our athletes. Off medications that may mask symptoms. This is another one from the guidelines, but another one that I put in quotes. Because again, there's a time, there's a place, and there are some situations where you will put someone on a medication and at some point, it is okay for them to go back. And the specific instance that I'll point out is people who have a strong history of migraine, let's say. Their family, numerous members of their family have migraine, and arguably they were destined to have migraine at some point. And like even with primary migraine, you have to have the genetics, and then there has to be something to trigger the expression of those genetics. And in this particular case, okay, did they have a head injury that then led to that cascade to where you have a migraine phenotype now at this point? Are we saying that this is a person who could never play sports ever again for the rest of their life? I would argue that that's probably not the right way to approach this. And if someone you think has the proclivity to have had migraine at some point in their life, I think that may be a very nuanced situation where they can return even though they're on medication. But I would say that that does take some really, that takes a lot of time and a lot of thought, and that's where some of the art in this comes in. So we want them at or near their baseline, and I would also say completely return to school or work because that's really the main objective of what we want for these student athletes especially. It reminds me of a friend of mine who actually just sent me an email a while back and said that he was working with a pole vaulter. She had a concussion while pole vaulting, and floridly symptomatic, requiring school accommodations. And then physically, she actually cleared up okay, but she wanted to go to high jumping. She decided to quit pole vaulting. She was going to high jump, and she was not finding herself to be symptomatic while high jumping. And the question was, she and her father wanted a return to play, and was she ready for a return to play? And I would argue no, because she has not yet been able to function at school without without a lot of accommodations. And so, we run across this all the time where, there's this imbalance between, what people want to do physically versus what they're actually capable of performing of academically. I won't go into computerized testing other than to say, we'll sometimes use it to eventually use our to make our return to play decision. I shouldn't say sometimes, frequently. And I know Dr. Condra will go into that in a little bit more detail. Frequently, we don't have a baseline, so we're left to rely on the knowledge and the wisdom of our neuropsychologists to kind of give us an idea of about where an athlete should be, or help us to track over time the point where their performance plateaus. Let's see here. Preventing future injuries, again, was the future part of the history. And part of that is the occupational medicine part of what we do. And some of that involves looking at technique. Is this someone who actually needs some specialized coaching on tackling technique, for instance? Are they coming to see you a little bit more frequently than they should be? Is this someone who actually has improper equipment? And you see this kid there with that helmet that's probably about five times too big for him. Or even looking at issues with the environment. So, if we find out from the history that a baseball player ran into the wall catching a fly ball, and we notice that there's no warning track there. Little things like that can mean a lot for the safety of their of their teammates, and of course for the future safety of themselves. The final return to play decision is also a little bit nuanced and very individualized, and a lot of that involves not only, again, knowing the athlete, but knowing about their sport. And I can't emphasize that enough. I've heard of individuals who don't necessarily know the sport that they're returning someone to play in. And you can't really make a good decision about the relative safety of going back into that environment unless you know exactly what they're going to be exposed to. So that's very important. Keeping in mind age and gender and specific positions within that sport. There's going to be various risks even from position to position. So, again, it's going to be important to make a very highly individualized decision on when someone is actually safe to return to play. Just a couple of points here. We're more conservative with youth athletes. We already mentioned that. Let's see here. Just in the sake of time, I'll skip ahead a couple of slides. This is not too different from the workflow slide you saw from Dr. Resch. I give 100% credit to my friends, my colleagues from Mayo Clinic, where I was before I left to UT Southwestern, that really I think innovated the way a clinic should work, in the sense that it was not a traditional concussion clinic, but it's called a return to play clinic, and I think that does a couple of things. Much in the way that, you know, when we talk about burnout in the workplace, and we've sort of shifted away from that to talk more about resilience and how to develop resilience, a return to play clinic does not focus on the negative aspects so much as what the positive end goal is going to be. Plus, it also incorporates a lot of people who don't have concussion. There are some people who hit their head and don't have a concussion. That's just the way it is, but they end up in your clinic. And sometimes they won't come because they don't need to go to a concussion clinic. But if they need to return to play, there you go. So it's actually very effective just in the way of reframing how we're thinking of it. Plus, it also is good in the sense that it is also very interdisciplinary in the way we've already discussed, in the sense that an individual will come in and they'll see our athletic trainer or physical therapist, and they'll go through some of the initial assessments, they'll get a good history, they'll get a very good detailed neurologic evaluation and an abbreviated neuropsychometric evaluation. And then there's a decision point, at which point either someone's kind of released or returned back to their primary, or they're given some sort of follow-up protocol. And the follow-up involves a lot of additional work with our athletic trainers and with our physical therapists. Because, as we saw earlier, exercise is good, exercise is important, exercise can help. And the other way of reframing this is to realize that this is a sports injury, and this is a sports injury that needs some legitimacy to it, because a lot of people just they can't get their heads around the fact that it's invisible to them. Nothing shows up on a CAT scan, and so I think if we treat them like athletes and we treat this like a sports injury, and we have a guided physical rehab, I think that's one of the reasons that this lends to a good outcome or a better outcome. I won't get into retiring an athlete just if they're not getting better, or if they have irreversible damage on imaging, or just if they express interest. And that happens. I have had professional athletes come to me and say, you know what, I think at this point I'm done. I've got too much going on with my family, and I have a future, and I don't want to do this anymore. And so because of that, autonomy is probably the cornerstone of this. And autonomy also means allowing someone, if they're an adult, to make bad decisions as well. And the best you can do is give your advice and then let them take your advice and do what they will with it. The conclusions really just reiterate what we were talking about here. And I won't delay with those, but it really takes a bunch of us in this room to really lead to the better outcome for a concussed athlete. It involves the parents, it involves the schools and the leagues. The athletic trainers are on the front line, and they're in the trenches, and I can't overemphasize how important they are to all of us. Our frontline providers, our team physicians, and then our specialty care providers, you know, neuropsychologists, neurologists, psychiatrists, you know, all of those people are so important, and all really at the center of it is the athlete. And I'll end there, and there's a couple ways to get a hold of me if you want to. That'll do it. And thank you so much.